So I haven't seen you guys since the national nightmare has begun. And I think each day brings greater and greater challenges internally and externally. Externally, it's getting to the point where it's almost impossible to up the ante on ignorance, greed, and hatred. Mean, really, I think it's gotten to a level where I wake up every morning and think, can they do something else? And yes. So, I wanted to kind of do a Dharma talk as a reminder tonight about the Buddha's position on politics and social upheaval. It's, he was a prince and then gave it all up. But because he was a prince for 28 years, Siddhartha actually had relationships with many of the royalty that were in the area. And it's one of the reasons why he was able for 40 years to have the ability to go to different regions depending on the season, and actually be hosted by kings. And so, as you know, the Pali Canon is just so extensive, 40 years of teachings. And so, actually, there is a teacher, a Vipassana teacher in the Goenka tradition. His name is Paul Fleischman. And I met Paul, gosh, it's got to be 20 years ago in Boston. He is actually, at this point, he was a psychiatrist. And when I met him 20 years ago, I think he was probably maybe a little older than I am at the time. So I don't even know if he's actually still alive. But he did write quite a bit about the Buddha, the Buddhist teachings, and Buddhist psychology. And one of the articles that he wrote was actually, and he wrote this for the Barry Center for Buddhist Studies. So he wrote an article on the difference between nonviolence and pacifism, because according to his thesis, the Buddha actually was preaching nonviolence and not preaching pacifism, even though I think if you look quite a bit at, popular writing about the Buddha, people think the Buddha was a pacifist. But actually, that's not true. So, and I kind of agree with him. So I thought that I would just put forth a little bit of his argument, just so you could make up your own mind. So he starts by giving two definitions. The first is of nonviolence. And he says nonviolence is the use of peaceful means, not force, to bring about political or social change. And then the second definition he gives is about pacifism. And he says pacifism is the belief that any violence, including war, is under any circumstances unjustifiable, and that all disputes should be settled by peaceful means. So again, his thesis is that the historical Buddha was practicing nonviolence and not pacifism. Personally, I just want to right off the bat say that there's a middle ground for me between nonviolence and pacifism, where I think the Buddha may fall into. And for me, the middle ground appears to be skillful and vigorous self-defense, free of hatred. So for the Buddha, every thought, every word, every act for him needed to be free of hatred. And so if you take the five precepts seriously, and the first one, of course, is ahimsa, which is non-violence, non-killing, non-harming of all kinds. And I think the middle ground looks like it's possible to be vigorous in your defense of your principles as long as you are not generating hatred toward someone who may be violating your principles. So you can see that this is a real sticky wick here, right? Because the first precept is very specific. Non-harming means non-harming. On the other hand, the Buddha was not a Jain. So J-A-I-N. So at the time of the historical Buddha, one of the sects of Hinduism broke off and it became Jainism. And the Jains are very famous for a kind of ahimsa, a kind of nonviolence that went so far that they would never step on an insect. Some of them, I'm not even sure what they ate, because some of them refused to step on vegetation or eat vegetation of any kind. I mean, this is a real extreme version of non-violence. And the Buddha, as far as I can tell, the Buddha did not have that kind of ahimsa in mind. He was more interested in making sure that suffering would not arise in the mind, in the heart, and then that means in thought, word, and deed. But I've never seen a reference to the Buddha giving a Dharma talk on not stepping on insects. I've never seen it. I don't know. As maybe somebody has seen it and you can tell me if you wish, but I've never seen it. So, passivism is super interesting according to this definition. It's a belief that any violence of any kind under any circumstances is completely unjustifiable and that all disputes should be settled by peaceful means. Well, there's at least one verse in the Pali Canon. It's actually in the Majjhima Nikaya somewhere. I forget where the Buddha is describing the what an enlightened being would be able to endure. And what he says is, rather than cause harm, he would be willing to have an enemy tear him limb from limb. This is an actual verse. Now, what's super interesting is the context. So the Buddha, the context for this is he is describing an enlightened mind and essentially calling out the empty nature of existence, of all phenomena, of all experiences, and saying, even someone who wants to tear me limb from limb, it's not a cause for me to get lost in hatred or any kind of act that would actually lead to violence based on my hatred. Again, this is a super sticky wick. And honestly, I'm doing this because even in my teeny little town of Gig Harbor, on April 5th, I don't know how 2,000 people in this town learned about it, but 2,000 people ended up on the streets in Gig Harbor on April 5th, protesting. And this is a very big military area. All the branches of the military have bases here. The Navy has a shipyard. There's most of the ships are actually built in Bremerton. And there's a very strong veteran and active military presence here. And they were out on the street with us protesting. And I'm pretty sure that there's going to be at least twice as many, maybe more, on Saturday for the No Kings rally, which Indivisible Gig Harbor is hosting a rally. And it was utterly, completely non-violent, meaning 2,000 people were on this corner, you know, this like the intersection, and extended over Highway 16 on the overpass. And it was pure joy. Pure joy. And this is kind of a conservative area. But I really, frankly, only saw one guy in a black pickup truck drive by us, giving us the finger. But he got stuck because there were, you know, literally there's lights, it's an intersection. And the joy was so intense. And of course, you know, nobody was yelling and screaming at him. He basically stopped. And most of the cars, people were honking and waving. It was like a love fest. It was the strangest, strangest experience. And I know that Saturday, given what is happening in Los Angeles yesterday and today, and it is unlawful, essentially, for a president of the United States to take the power away from the governor of California and call the National Guard to go and show up and stop peaceful protest. And maybe some of you saw the pictures today. Tens of thousands of peaceful protesters showed up in Los Angeles today. Peaceful. In fact, on April 5th, 5.3 million people around this country were out in the streets, and there wasn't a single incident. So it really is possible to bring about political and social change using nonviolence, not force. And the Buddha was a big, big proponent of this. There's a brief discourse where the Buddha is challenged by a general.
Yes.
And the general claimed that the Dhamma is mere passivity. And then Buddha basically turned to him and he said that all he teaches is inactivity in regard to unwholesome things, and activity by way of good conduct in deeds, words, and thoughts. That's a quote. That's all he says to the general. He actually doesn't tell the general what is good conduct for him. He merely tells him what he teaches. So I'll say it again. Inactivity with respect to unwholesome thoughts, speech, and deed. And activity by way of good conduct in deeds, words, and thoughts. So I think you can hear the clarity that the Buddha had. A Buddhist practitioner can be on the streets with a sign, standing up for democracy and freedom in America and the rule of law, and call out injustice and wrongdoing, and be following the first precept, non-harming. So you might be wondering, as I wonder, you might be wondering, what does it take to do that? I mean, this is big. And it's a lot to ask, right? So I think what I would like to do is offer maybe a bit more instruction. So one of the things the Buddha preached about a lot in the Pali Canon was resolve. Sometimes he called it resolution. And this resolve or resolution, it always referred to firm mental determination, or sometimes strong intention. In fact, the second of the Eightfold Noble Path, which is usually translated as right intention, can also be translated as right resolve. So the Buddha, there is a passage from the analysis of the path. This is in the Samyutta Nikaya. It's 45.8. It's a very long sutta. And there's one little passage here on resolve. And this is what the Buddha said. He says, "And what is right resolve? Being resolved on renunciation, on freedom from ill will, on harmlessness. This is called right resolve." So the three things in this passage that he suggested to have strong intention, firm mental determination, is to be resolved on renunciation, non-hatred, and non-harming. There is also another passage which is attributed to Sariputra, and Sariputta was one of the Buddha's main disciples. And he stated that the Buddha identified four specific kinds of resolve. And these four resolves are wisdom, truth, renunciation, and the fourth is tranquility. And I really like this one a lot. It's not that I don't like that little passage before, but this one, I feel as though it's got meat. You know, you can really dig your teeth into this one, and you can practice resolve. So in order to have resolve, you actually want to be looking to gain these four qualities. Wisdom, so prajna is the Sanskrit word, and this is clear seeing, clarity. Truth, the truth is super interesting, obviously. Yeah, we all know truth can be relative. However, this truth that Sariputta is pointing at is a sense of having your compass, knowing what is true for you. And that's super important if you're out in the street, because you're out in the street. You're showing up. And so you better know why you're showing up. And then renunciation is very important in a situation like showing up in the streets and protesting, because there are many things a person has to relinquish when you go out on the street. And one of the things, one of the big things I think a person has to relinquish is vengeance and hatred. It's very possible to call out injustice and wrongdoing without generating hatred toward the wrongdoer. And I found it interesting that tranquility actually comes after relinquishment, because renunciation and relinquishing of vengeance, a sense of self-righteousness, these kinds of emotions and wrong thinking, when you let them go, the mind becomes tranquil and clear. And that is prajna. So it's possible through relinquishment and tranquility to know the truth and to see it completely clearly. So the other quality that I wanted to bring up is restraint. You know, restraint is a little different than renunciation, although honestly, I feel in order to actually accomplish restraint, one must be continually relinquishing all kinds of things, but mostly a sense of self-importance, self-obsession. There has to be some way to include yourself in the context, to not see yourself as separate from everyone on the street, even not to see oneself as separate necessarily from the wrongdoers. Because honestly, ask yourself, you know, we're all human. We're all capable of wrongdoing. I know I have, and I'm sure at some point in the future, I will mindlessly wrongdo again. This is our nature. And so restraint for me at its core has this sense of deep understanding of the compassionate recognition of the ubiquitousness of human suffering. We all have it. Some of us have it more than others, but there isn't a single human that doesn't. And that gives rise for me to two things that the Buddha mentioned. There is actually a sutta on restraint, and I don't have time tonight to go through the whole thing. Maybe I can do this in the fall, but the Restraint Sutta has a very interesting title. It's called No Falling Away. And the entire Sutta on Restraint is about how, when one is endowed with four very important qualities, it's impossible to fall away, which means not quite falling off the wagon, but more getting lost in mindlessness, losing the vigilance that the Buddha is so famous for encouraging us to have. And the four qualities for restraint is, of course, virtue is the first one. And virtue gives us the instruction about guarding the doors to our five senses and our sixth sense, which is the sense base of the narrative mind, and guarding the doors so that conduct is virtuous, even if one is in a situation that is not virtuous. Certainly not of our own doing, because honestly, we could stop. But if we are in a situation where there is non-virtue happening and we are seeing the non-virtuous conduct, hearing it, we can allow ourselves to have the restraint to remember what is virtuous conduct for us as Buddhist practitioners. The third quality of restraint for the Buddha is moderation in eating. And I really like this one, mostly because I think it's a catch-all for desire, for moderation in everything, not getting lost. And it's really possible to get very caught up and very lost when you're protesting in the moment and lose one's sense of propriety. And as Buddhist practitioners, it's important for us to show up with a sense of restraint and care and wisdom. And that is possible when we are devoted to wakefulness, awareness, not getting lost in our thoughts, remaining present. Super, super important. So, having gone through all this, I decided that the Buddha actually was both nonviolent as well as a pacifist, because I couldn't find any passage in any of the Pali Canon where the Buddha was doing harm to someone. I mean, he could be pretty strong with his words, and yet I don't ever remember him telling someone they're a complete and total idiot. He always was firm with giving wisdom. And so for me, unlike for Paul Fleischman, for me, the Buddha actually was both. He was preaching nonviolence, and his conduct was very much eschewing any violence under any circumstances. So I don't know if any of you will be out in the streets on Saturday. And if you will be out in the streets, I hope that this was helpful in some way. And please be safe. Things are a little different than they were on April 5th. So be safe out there. So I think we have a couple of minutes, maybe if anybody has anything they want to add or questions or anything, just unmic yourself. Just unmic.
Yeah, I did run into a Suda a couple of years ago, and I don't have the reference, but I found it kind of shocking. Buddha was talking to one of his king pals, I forget which one, might have been Bimbisara, and he said, "Oh yeah, you're a good king. You do all the things that good kings do." And then he listed things like administration of justice, but he also included wage war, and he included you execute criminals. This is the stuff that good kings have to do. So, congratulations for being a good king.
So Paul Fleischman actually brings this up in his article. And it's a different king than that. And but he says that the Buddha always found a way to never eschew what practically might have to happen, but he also was not a big proponent of it. So again, this is why he said that the Buddha practiced nonviolence and not pacifism. Thank you. So you were shocked when you read that? Are you still on? There you
I'm on. Yeah, I
are.
was a bit surprised, but there are other places where the Buddha seems to countenance behaviors that he does not tolerate within his own community. Another example is slavery. He tells a local leader that he, well, somebody sort of hints to him, you really shouldn't take in escaped slaves because that's not going to look good to others. I'm a good king and I can tolerate that and understand it, but others might not take so lightly to it. So, the Buddha put in a rule, no escape, no desert. No soldier deserters from the army, no escaped slaves. He was very careful not to upset the powers around him.
Well, that was because they were giving him the ability to camp out based on the seasons. Rick, you raised your hand, and then I think Jen, you can unmic yourself, Rick. So you have to turn your mic. There we go. Okay.
Okay. Yes. In 1965, I was a 20-year-old. I dropped out of college, UC Berkeley, and joined the civil rights movement.
Good for you.
And very naive, uneducated in all kinds of stuff. And I wound up in Americus, Georgia, camping out on a collective farm run by the Quakers. And was introduced to meditation. They were meditating and also participating in the demonstrations. And subsequently I got we got attacked by the Ku Klux Klan, and I got beaten very severely by them with clubs, got thrown in jail. I had a crash course in nonviolence without hardly any understanding of that or anything about it. And I was very impressed by the American friends, the Quakers, who were meditating and running the farm and also participating in the demonstrations because they had the air of equanimity about them, which was, you know, contagious. And so I proceeded to carry on from there to the anti-Vietnam War and anti-nuclear and Redwood Summer and Saturday I'll be out on Flag Day. It's Flag Day.
Well, very good.
Over on the overpass with my thing, upside down flags. And I've been studying this stuff ever since. Been jailed a bunch of times and never really got attacked like that so much. Maybe a little bit by the police, but never by my primary introduction to nonviolence. And so, you know, I've been dealing with that and pondering it all ever since.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that with us.
And that my question is,
yes,
with regards to organized self-defense,
yes,
like the Russians invading and those people are producing what I would consider a nonviolent self-defense, in that they only attack and kill the Russian invaders. They do not go after the Russian people.
So what is your question?
Well, it seems to me that would be the middle path.
Well, so I think that we are talking as Buddhist practitioners this evening.
Yeah.
And we're not talking about matters of state. And so I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on the choices of the Ukrainian leader. And I can only say that that war has no legitimacy whatsoever. So that I think that's all I can say.
You would take the pacifist attitude toward war.
No, I said that war has no legitimacy, is what I am saying. But I don't think it's appropriate for me to comment on what is happening in Ukraine. I don't live there, so I don't think it's appropriate. But thank you for sharing your wonderful history.
Well, that's my conundrum these days.
I think we're going to let someone else speak, and then we really have to end. So thank you so much, Rick.
I thank you very much for bringing up the subject.
No problem. Jen?
My question is very quick. At the beginning, you gave us a word for the desire to become enlightened, and I tried to write it down, and I didn't catch it.
Oh, bhavana. B-H-A-V-A-N-A. Bhavana. Yes.
I liked it a lot. Thank you.
It's amazing that bhavana is not talked about more.
No.
Bhavana, actually, the first time I heard it, Maharishi Mahesh Yogi was teaching on bhavana. And then the second time I heard it actually was Philip. But, you know, Philip was a Raja Yogi before he was a Buddhist yogi. So there are many things that, you know, Philip would say that I would say, oh, of course, I do remember that. Yeah. So, yes, bhavana. And bhavana is important, just so you know, because people mistake. They say, you know, with Buddhists, you can't have any desires. Well, you know, if we didn't have the desire to wake up, nobody would wake up, right?
It doesn't happen by accident.
That's right. That is bhavana.
Thank you.